The J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. Sam, have you got Olympic fever? Because I know I have.
Oh, absolutely. I was up at, what time was it? I think I started watching the triathlon at 10:30 last night, and then I was watching, who knows what I was watching at 3 o'clock. My sleep time has completely gone, but yeah, watching as much of the Olympics as possible. How about you? Are you enjoying this coinciding with a break from work?
Absolutely, very much so. Yes, I've watched an awful lot of skateboarding, the street version, in the last couple of days, and yes, it's paid off in spades with Japan winning the gold in both the men's and the women's. So yeah, absolutely terrific. And with no spectators, of course, it's kind of obviously a hollow atmosphere pretty much everywhere around all of the venues, not only in Tokyo but of course elsewhere around the country, especially up to the north. But yeah, it's happening, and it looks like it's going to continue. So we'll make the most of it. And obviously we're here as a football podcast to talk about football. So we will do that and talk about the men's and the women's football tournaments happening at the moment at Tokyo 2020. Obviously with a focus on the Japan under 24 men and Nadeshiko Japan. We will begin, I guess, on the bright side, Sam, with the men on this week's podcast, who are two wins from two, very contrasting performances from two very different looking games. But ultimately, Japan are sitting on top of Group A after beating South Africa 1-0 last Thursday, and then Mexico 2-1 on Sunday.
Yeah, it's been going very well. As you say, the South Africa game, it wasn't the greatest performance from Japan. They came up against a very stubborn, obdurate side in South Africa who defended deep. And Japan had a lot of possession, but really kind of were lacking ideas in that game. So there were worries, I think, from a lot of people going into the Mexico game, given Mexico's performance against France when they absolutely tore them apart. But, I mean, Japan started that game incredibly well, two goals inside 10 minutes. And, the first 30 minutes was as good as I've seen any Japan team play. The high press, they're causing the errors. They were, right in at Mexico. And I thought Wataru Endo had one of the games of his life. I mean, he did absolutely everything in that midfield. You know, I mean, we've heard things about him Germany, but just to watch him in action, I thought it was absolutely incredible. And, Japan tried to make it a little bit more difficult for themselves towards the end of that game, but it was a really promising performance.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder if Endo's added another zero to his next transfer fee. He's certainly been excellent in the first two games with the Mexico one. For many people, I guess, his coming out party. We've known how excellent he's been in the past couple of years, and obviously, Stuttgart supporters know all about him as well. But terrific performance from Endo. But of course, it's Takafusa Kubo who is grabbing most of the headlines in the Japanese media. He scored the winner to finally break South Africa's resistance in the opener last Thursday night. His goal coming after he took a crossfield pass from Al Tanaka and swept home to the keeper's far post with just under 20 minutes to go. And then, as you say, Sam, Japan made a rip-roaring start against Mexico to silence any of their doubters who were wondering how they were going to get on against the more fancied Mexican team. And myself included there, I was, feeling a bit flat after the South Africa game, even though Japan ultimately emerged with all 3 points. But yes, that start with Kubo netting again, we'd gotten used to him setting up Ritsu Doan in the warm-up games, but Doan returned the favour here, and Kubo poked home first time, or should I say swept home with the outside of his boot, to give him a little bit more credit. And then, you can talk about the first goal, Sam, but I'd like to move on and talk about the penalty, which was awarded after a VAR decision. And I'll tell you what, if you want to talk about the first goal in a little bit more detail, feel free to do that, because, I don't know, I think I've got a little bit of an issue with the penalty decision. But, Kubo sweeping Japan into a very early lead.
Well, I look forward to a potential this week in Bar for the Olympics. That'd be interesting. But yeah, I thought the first goal was really good. It was a quick break down the right-hand side, just really nicely swept forward. Doan out there, and him and Kubo have got a really good understanding, and they know where each other are. It has been a little frustrating for some of the games in some of the time in these games where they maybe tried a little bit too much or maybe gone a little bit too far, tried to take on an extra player. But when it works, it really does work. It was a great cutback, and Kubo, yeah, it was a wonderful shot for the outside of his boot. It was all technique, no sort of toe bunt or anything like that. So yeah, it was a really good goal. And I'll let you say your piece about this penalty.
Yeah, all right. Well, it's ultimately benefited Japan, so I shouldn't really be kicking up too much of a stink. But yeah, it's a special occasion, so I might as well throw the jingle in. This week in VAR. This week in VAR. This week. So Sam, yeah, this is something that we've talked about earlier on in the season, I think, with VAR, and it's incidents like this when Yuki Sōma was caught by a defender in the split second after he'd attempted across the box. I mean, I should give credit to Alan Gibson. As I scrolled up my Twitter timeline, he was right on it, saying that yeah, Sōma had been caught late, and that the commentators on TV had not noticed. One of the many criticisms Alan had about the commentary team on this particular occasion. But yeah, I mean, to me, that just looks like an occasion that we see, you know, five or six times every game where a striker is clattered after he gets a shot away. Usually, obviously, it sails over the bar and then he's taken out by a defender, either a sliding defender or somebody coming across to try and get him, preventing him from getting his shot away in the first place. So, I don't know, this hasn't affected the path of the cross that Solma's made. I mean, he's caught slightly on his boot, and I mean, I know you said as well on Twitter that you thought it was a good spot by the VAR once the penalty was actually awarded, but for me, this is something that we see, in most games happening where an attacker is caught slightly late after usually getting a shot away, but in Sōma's case, a cross. So for me, I felt it was an unnecessary VAR decision. But again, yeah, I shouldn't really be saying anything.
Yeah, I think it's one where I'm going to try and bail out the commentators here, because it is one that nobody before VAR would have considered as a penalty. It was just a normal thing that happened. Someone tries to slide into the block, there's usually a bit of contact, but everyone just goes away with it, and that's that. So that's, I think with VAR being brought in, they do look at these. Sometimes it can be a little bit pernickety, and I'm sure our Mexican supporters will think this was a little bit one of those, because when you slow it down and look at it, and then he has just caught him maybe ankle high or so with the studs up, I think he has to give it when he sees it that way. I think prior to VAR, I don't think this would ever be given as a penalty, but with the technology, it kind of changes the way that decisions are made. And I think now with all of it in, it is always going to be a penalty. And for Japan's sake, I'm very happy for that. I don't know whether it's something I completely agree with in terms of VAR being able to look at everything in such minute detail to bring penalties where no one would have complained previously. That's one of the an issue with it, but on this occasion it did look like a foul, and I'm pretty happy with the decision, trying to be as neutral as possible. I think he has caught Sōma late, and yeah, I think it was fair as a penalty.
This week in VAR. This week in VAR. This week. Yeah, okay, so it was awarded after a deliberation through VAR, and the referee, after going over and checked the monitor, was pretty prompt in making the decision. Richard Doan smashed his penalty down the middle, and Japan led 2-0 just past the 10-minute mark. And from there, Sam, they controlled things. They even saw Mexico go down to 10 men, and it all looked set up for an absolute cruise. But we know with Japan in major tournaments, we should never take anything for granted. And I guess the decision from Hajime Moriyasu to put Kosei Tani in goal, when most of us expected it would be a Keisuke Osako, well, it was going all right through the first game and through the first 85 minutes of the second, but then Tani was embarrassed by a Roberto Alvarado free kick with 5 minutes to go that set up a frantic finale.
Yeah, it was an interesting call at the start of the tournament. Yeah, Osago had been the favoured one. I don't think necessarily there's too much between the two goalkeepers. Both have played well and regularly for Hiroshima and for Shonan, so I didn't think it was like the wildest decision that he made to bring Tani in. And he had done fairly well in the limited amount of stuff he had to do, because South Africa barely threatened and Mexico got to a point but without really creating too much. So, yeah, this was one of those where you'd say it was unfortunate, but he looks a bit foolish as the ball goes through past him and he's just flicking out a leg. So, yeah, it was unfortunate for him. I was glad for him that a couple of minutes later, although hearts in mouths with the Mexicans attacking the goal, but he did redeem himself somewhat with a very good save from a header. So I'm glad he got that under his belt straight away and he doesn't lose too much confidence from the way that, yeah, he conceded. But, yeah, it was a disappointing one, but who's to say Osaka wouldn't have done exactly the same.
Yeah, fair enough then. All right, so it's two wins from two, and before we move on and talk about Nadeshko Japan, obviously it looks very rosy for the men's under-24 team, but they, you know, they're still in some danger of not making it through to the quarterfinals with this game coming up against France. France, who, as you said, looked pretty poor in the first game against Mexico, or Mexico looked terrific, probably a 6-1, half a dozen of the other. And then France have somehow escaped their second group stage game against South Africa with a 4-3 victory. So they are still alive. And, Japan are going to have to be wary. And again, if they're showing any weaknesses, this France team, although it's certainly not the strongest incarnation of a Les Bleus side, they could sense blood in the water. And this final group stage game on Wednesday could be absolutely anything.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you play France and you have to get a result in it, it's never going to be an easy affair. I think it's kind of a hodgepodge of a French team, but there is enough quality in there that are going to cause problems. I mean, Gignac, yeah, he's getting on a bit, but it's just off the back of a hat-trick. He's a very good striker. If Japan give him any sort of space, he's going to take it. And then Tovan in behind him is a very good attacking midfielder. So there is quality that Japan have got to be aware of. They can't go into the game on 6 points and think, yeah, all we have to do is not lose by two goals or more and then try and cruise it. I just think as long as Japan, though, if they set up with the same intensity that they did at the start of the game against Mexico, they will be okay. But, yeah, just you've got to make sure you're switched on, because even if it is a poorer France side than you'd expect, there's still a good amount of quality in there and they can hurt Japan if they don't turn up.
Most definitely. And so what about the lineups that Moriyasu was put out in the first two games? We don't have to go through them in extensive detail, but I think before the tournament, most of us would have expected to see Takehiro Tomiyasu alongside the captain Maya Yoshida in central defence. Instead, Tomiyasu has not featured at all, and Koi Takura has been Yoshida's partner in both of those games. And I think, yeah, there were some eyebrows raised, and again, Tomiyasu is probably fitness, and if you tell me that, then fair dues. But, to not see Kaoru Mitoma in the 18-man matchday squad in the first game certainly raised some eyebrows, and he was only coming off the bench for inside, I think, the last 10 minutes against Mexico. So we haven't seen him at all. He could be an absolute wild card against the French, no question. But, some of the personnel decisions, I guess, Tani versus Osako in goal aside, Sam, that you've noticed in the first two group stage games?
Yeah, well, first with Tomiyasu, he's nursing an ankle injury, so hasn't been able to train fully. I think he was close to getting back for the Mexico game, but wasn't risked. I mean, Anita Kerr has performed very well in that position. He's a good defender in his own right, so Japan haven't looked like they've missed Tomiyasu too much, and maybe if they get him fit for maybe the France game, or if he's fit for the last 16, that's a perfect player to come in. As with the Mitoma, him and Daizen Maeda both came into the tournament with knocks as well. Mitoma had his, I think, in the last ACL game, I think, so he hasn't been training completely right, so he wasn't risked in that first game. And then they played Sommer at left wing against Mexico, and I think it was just for his ability to defend from the front, which really worked in that first half, so I thought that was a good tactical decision. And then Hayashi has been the one who's played up front with I mean, Ueda also was coming in with a few fitness issues, so he's kind of been forced into these decisions, but I thought Hayashi up front has done really well. I mean, I don't think he looks like he's going to score very often, at least in this team, but the work he does up front in terms of his pressing, in terms of his holding up the ball and allowing players like Kubo and Doan to play around him, I think he's done really well. So I've been pretty impressed with the decisions so far that have been made by Moriyasu, even if quite a few of them have been forced on him.
All right, then, fair enough. So, as we said, Wednesday night, Japan versus France for a spot in the Olympic quarterfinals. Of course, a draw would be enough to see Japan through. A defeat by a single goal would also take them through on goal difference ahead of the French. But, if they were to lose by two goals, that would be curtains, presuming, of course, that Mexico beat South Africa in the other game. If that were not to be the case, then Japan would automatically go through, as they already have 6 points from their two games. So that's all to play for on Wednesday night. The night before that, Nadeshiko Japan have their moment of reckoning when they will face off against Chile, Sam. And to say Nadeshiko Japan have it all to do after their first two group stage games is a massive understatement. We previewed them last week with Alex Bishop, and a lot of what Alex said on the last week's episode has come to pass. Possession for possession's sake against Canada, I would say, without looking particularly threatening. But then in the second game against Great Britain, Sam, they just couldn't keep the ball at all, could they? And they slumped to a 1-0 defeat after Ellen White scored with 16 minutes to go. So, Nadeshiko Japan certainly have not lived up to expectations so far.
Yeah, I've been so disappointed with them. As I said, we're coming into a little bit blind, except for what Alex said last week. And I've always thought that Nadeshiko Japan were always a good side. We're always like kind of intense and going for it and playing good football. But these two games have been really poor. That first half, I think maybe the occasion got to them and the early goal really startled them, because Canada took the lead after about 5 minutes, and then the rest of that first half it was really poor from Japan. They didn't create anything. They didn't really keep the ball too well. I think they were restricted to maybe one long range effort, and just really it was a lack of intensity I saw from them in that game. And then it seemed like it was turning a corner a little bit in the second half. They won a penalty very early that was a miss, which maybe took the wind out of the sails again, but it looked a lot better. They were going for it a bit more, and then there was a moment of quality from Iwabuchi that saw them through. But then against GB, I mean, first of all, why Iwabuchi isn't starting is beyond me. She's the key player for this team, the one player really of absolute star quality that can turn a game for them, but they didn't go with her up front, which was very weird. And then again, it was a lack of intensity against Britain. I mean, GB have played very well so far in this tournament, but they're not a team that Japan should go up against. I think we just have to try and eke out a draw here. But that's kind of what they did. They just were happy with it at 0-0. There was very little about them that went to, they wanted to take the game to GB. And like, especially second half, Britain completely controlled it. They were brushing Japan off the ball. They were not getting anywhere near them and just completely dominated the game. And once they scored, Japan had no real response. They eventually brought Iwabuchi on after about 80 minutes, but it was too little too late. And it was just very disappointing. And now they have a very big game coming up against Chile.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, so Canada in the opener. Yeah, Canada scored after 6 minutes through Christine Sinclair. And then, as Sam's mentioned, Iwabuchi's moment of quality with 6 minutes to go saw Japan rescue a point. I mean, that is an absolutely class finish, isn't it, from Iwabuchi, considering she's hardly had a sniff all game. Anything she tried to pass forward, especially in the first half to Sugasawa, just didn't stick at all. She'd had no joy at all in this game, Sam, too. So, to do that, to finish as calmly as she did and as superbly as she did just inside the post with 6 minutes to go with two defenders bearing down on her was, that was just a perfect exemplar of her class, wasn't it?
Absolutely. The run, first of all, was very clever, and the ball to her is very good. And the key to the goal is she just takes it early, and the goalkeeper is not set. It was a substitute goalkeeper at that point. The Canada number one had already been taken off through injury, so maybe she wasn't quite ready. But, yeah, the early shot deceives the goalkeeper, completely out of her reach. And, yeah, it was a real quality finish, and it's kind of the one moment of quality I've seen from Japan across the two games. And, I mean, answers on a postcard as to why she didn't start that second game. It completely baffled me.
Oh, yeah, or as you say, you didn't take the penalty early on in the second half. That absolutely, that did my absolute head in. I could not believe that at all. Mina Tanaka, fair dues to you, but, your best player should be taking that penalty. And, it was saved by the Canadian keeper, who then had to go off injured shortly after. Let's see if any listeners pick me up on my use of the word exemplament, and we'll see if anybody can come up with a dictionary definition of that, because I don't think you'll be able to find one. But I guess we have to talk about the Great Britain game, even though the less said about it, the better from a Japanese perspective, Sam. As you say, they were just really weak in possession, weren't they, and so easily brushed off the ball. It was... Really hard to see where they were trying to get anything out of the game from it. And to seemingly set your stall out for a 0-0 draw in a game like this where, as you say, Great Britain are a strong team, but they're hardly world beaters, although they could go on to obviously medal in this competition. But, it was really stark lack of ambition and overall a really flat performance. So whether they can... just flick a switch like Japan men's did against Mexico in the first 10 minutes. We'll wait and see. But have you seen anything from Chile in their first two games? Obviously, they played Team GB in the opener and then, Canada in the second game last Saturday. Are they likely to... Well, they could obviously pose a huge threat to Japan, because they could still make it through themselves as one of the best third-place finishers if they happen to win this game.
Well, they're definitely going to cause problems for them. I mean, whether they can go through or not, I don't think it's likely, but I mean, there's a chance for them, I suppose. But yeah, they're still playing at an Olympic Games, and for these players to get a point or a goal, it's going to be incredible for them. They might never be at this level again, so they're always going to be up for it. I mean, the first game they played against GB, and GB were very much in control, and Chile didn't cause too many issues. But the Canada game, I'm relying on the BBC commentary for this one during the Britain game, but they seem to take the game a bit more to Canada. They caused them a few problems, maybe lacked a little bit of quality, but yeah, they got that to a 2-1 scoreline, which is pretty decent against one of the better teams in this competition. So Japan cannot take them lightly, and they'll have to improve on the two performances so far, because for any team against the host nation, which gives them extra motivation, I think they're going to be right up for this. So Japan can't just look to this game and think, okay, we can beat Chile and go through and it's going to be as simple as that, because it won't be. And it just seemed like, I don't know if, correct me if you think differently, but it seemed like the idea was just to coast through the first two games and at least with that point in the bank and just rely on this Chile game. I think that must be the reason why Iwabuchi wasn't starting, just to be rested for the Chile game. And but it just... it really didn't make sense to me, and I don't think you can take that risk against any team in this competition. You never know what's going to happen in any given game. They could go down to 10 players after a couple of minutes and they can be completely up against it. So, it's really confused me how Japan, the women have approached this tournament, and they could be in for a rude awakening against Chile.
Yeah, all right, so all to play for. And believe it or not, listeners, Japan could even make it through to the quarterfinals with a draw on Tuesday night. Or, in fact, Sam, could they even go through even if they lost by a single goal? Because, with the two of the three third-place group finishers going through, and China and Zambia drawing in their game in Group F, that means that... there's a lot of permutations, but basically a draw could be enough to see Japan through, and a win would certainly take them through to the quarterfinals, either as the the best third place team from Group E, or as the group runner up. And then the quarterfinals, where, as we said last week, 8 of the 12 teams make it. There are a couple of different venues that Japan could be playing at in the quarterfinals. But I guess first things first, Sam, they just want to make it through.
Yeah, and I think we've been wrapping our heads, we're trying to get our heads around these permutations, but a loss, of course, wouldn't be enough because Chile would go ahead of them. So we've got to just look at the China and Zambia results for that. But so, yeah, Japan do need at least a draw, which in all likelihood is going to send them through, because the Netherlands and Brazil should beat China and Zambia. But yeah, let's not play for that. Let's get a nice, clean 3-0 victory or something and go through with a bit of positivity.
Did I just say that they could go through even if they lost?
I think you said a narrow defeat.
Well, there you go. That's how confusing it is, listeners, with 8 of the 12 teams going through. So I humbly apologise. I did know that were, they couldn't make it through if they lost. But yeah, if they draw, they could and probably will make it through. And I think I should just cut this segment while I'm only slightly behind, Sam. So that's our look at the Olympic football tournaments. We obviously wish the women all the best on Tuesday night, and then the men as well on Wednesday, and hopefully next week on we'll be talking about how they've gotten on in their respective quarterfinals. So we're about halfway home, listeners. After a quick hit of music, Sam and I will be back to wrap up the 4 J1 games played in the past week. Welcome back, and the two Osaka clubs were very busy over the last week, weren't they, Sam? With Gumba at home last Wednesday and Saturday, Cerezo at home on Wednesday, and then they travel down to Tosu on the weekend. Goals galore, but ultimately, as we begin talking about Gumba, a very disappointing week, all things considered, with two odd goal defeats, but defeats they were at the end of the day, and that will have left them very flat.
Yeah, they were fairly disappointing performances as well. And I do feel for Gamba, their run here is quite horrendous, the amount of fixtures they have to play. And they've got a lot of injuries in their squad and are trying to rotate as much as possible. But it kind of leaves them a little bit disjointed. And yeah, they've not really got it together. Even though they took the lead against Kobe, they were then undone really by crosses into the box where the fullbacks are not great. Well, they're not really playing fullbacks, especially on the right-hand side. Okuno was played there for a bit when Anose has been rested, and Kurikawa's not very good, really, on the left-hand side. So they kind of got done by those two, and then Shoji or Miura, whoever might be in the box, didn't really have much chance against a couple of Douglas headers. And yeah, Gamba then didn't really get back into that game. And then at the weekend, there were a lot of shots, mainly for Kashima Antlers. They kind of dominated most of the game. Gamba didn't really get going again until Wellington Silva came on late in the game. So yeah, it was a couple of poor performances for Gamba. They're still in the relegation zone, and they have now a big 6-pointer coming up on Tuesday.
Yes, indeed. So just ever so briefly, last Wednesday, Gumba fell 2-1 at home against Kobe in a Kansai derby. Defending was seemingly optional for the first half hour of this game. Wellington Silva was afforded an awful amount of time to send in his cross, and Patrick surged through the centre and was unmarked to tap home in the 19th minute. And then, two terrific headers from Kobe. The first from Douglas in the 27th minute from a corner, headed back across Masaki Higashiguchi. And then Junior Tanaka, who might be going some way towards filling Kyogo Furuhashi's boots, with a terrific header from Gotoku Sakai cross. That came just a minute after a superb Ryotaro Hironaga save kept the game at 1-1. And then, Kobe struck literally in the next minute. And then, as you say, on Saturday, Sam, it was an awful lot of shots raining in from Kashima Antlers, but they finally broke the deadlock in the 72nd minute when a pair of substitutes combined. They came on together in the 65th minute, did Ryotaro Araki and Arthur Kaike. Araki's through ball was smashed home, first time by Kaike, with 18 minutes to go, and that was the only goal of the game. And Gumba, they have an awful lot to do now in these next four games that they're going to play over the course of the next 2 weeks, Sam. And as you say, they're trying to rotate. They're trying to keep the players fresh. But, yeah, these two defeats have, left them on the back foot. And, well, they're obviously still playing catch-up against the majority of the league. But, yeah, they do have some big fixtures coming up in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think the next four before everyone else joins up, they've got Oita on Tuesday, then away at Sapporo, away at Sendai, and then at home to Marinos. So if you're looking as a Gamba supporter, you think 3 points against Oita, 3 points against Sendai are particularly crucial, and that would get them a little bit clear of the relegation zone. So that is kind of the ideal thing for them. But yeah, a lot of these teams are coming in a lot fresher than Gamba. They're going to be up for it, especially Oita and Sendai. And if they don't beat those teams and still end up in this relegation zone when they're all back all square going into that Monday round of fixtures we've got coming up in April, then, yeah, Gamba in a world of trouble. They have to, I think, absolute minimum, I think, is 6 points from these four games. And, I mean, yeah, the injury issues are causing a lot of problems. They need to get a few of those back, because when they do rotate, they do lose a bit of quality in this team. And they're a team at the moment that aren't playing well enough to kind of cope with that sort of rotation. They're not really, even the games that they do win, they're winning just kind of squeaking past teams, as they did against Fukuoka. So yeah, it's still going to be a long old run for Gamba, and that the fatigue is going to catch them up. So the sooner they can get out of the relegation zone, the better for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's the most eye-catching stat of the season, the most eye-popping stat of the season, isn't it, Sam? They've played 18 league games at Gamba, and they've only scored 9 league goals. Mm. It's to say it's un-Gamba-esque is, frankly unbelievable, really. And, they've got to dig themselves out. And as you say, yeah, against a couple of fellow occupants of the relegation zone in the next couple of weeks, in the form of Oita and Sendai. And if they can get anything against Sapporo, who have edged their way up into the top half, and obviously second place Yokohama F. Marinos, who will be very refreshed by the time that game comes around, the final game before the league as a whole restarts. We'll see. But yeah, Gamba have it all to do in the next couple of weeks. They endured a very frustrating week. It was all systems go. It was all action, though, for their city rivals, Cerezo, Sam, who fought out a couple of, frankly, amazing 3-3 draws that were, we haven't spent an awful lot of time on the podcast this week. It will be a much shorter version than usual, but we could spend literally hours talking about these two Cerezo games, couldn't we? They were absolutely action-packed, goals flying in at both ends, both games ending 3-3, and, it could have been several more in both occasions.
Yeah, it was absolute box office from Cerezo Osaka, and it was two games that really they could have been completely out of. I mean, Tokyo were almost 3-0 up if it wasn't for a couple of inches on an offside call against Adalton, and then against Sagan Tosu. Tosu were incredible at the start of that game to go 2-0 up, and it just looked like there was one-way traffic. So, yeah, I've got to give a lot of credit to Cerezo. They're coming back off the ACL, where in general they played their strongest team throughout that tournament, and they've got to be running on fumes towards the end of these games, but they're dragging themselves back into it and getting these results 3-3. I mean, yeah, full credit to them. I don't think at the start of the season we'd necessarily have said Cerezo Osaka would have back-to-back, would be the team for back-to-back 3-3 draws. It doesn't seem quite like them, but it's been, yeah, really exciting to watch. So, yeah, good for them for getting back into it, because the situation, not quite as difficult as Gamba's, but it was quite difficult coming back from the ACL, and putting in those recoveries is, yeah, very good. And, yeah, so credit to them. But I think both Tokyo and Tosu will have their regrets from the two games.
Most definitely. And Tokyo supporters will want me to remind you of the near jinx that you put on us in last week's episode, Sam. You said it was time for Tokyo to make a statement performance as they push towards an ACL place. And, I mean, it was looking pretty good for you after Tokyo led 2-0 through Leandro and Diego Oliveira. Diego's goal coming in the 39th minute. And as you say, an inches in a VAR decision literally a minute later when Leandro thought he'd scored his second, but Adalton was offside in the build-up. Tokyo thought they were going 3-0 up, but then by the 75th minute, they were down and needing a Leandro special with 8 minutes to go, a Leandro free kick to ultimately earn Tokyo a share of the spoils.
Yeah, well, apologies to Tokyo fans. I'll pick a different victim next week, maybe. But at 3-0, well, as I thought it was 3-0 before the offside was given, I had a very cockily written tweet there saying that I'd beaten the jinx that I had to delete pretty quickly after that was recalled. And then, yeah, I mean, maybe it wore out a little bit at 3-2 and allowed Leandro's free kick to go in, because Kim gets two hands to it and really should push it away. So at least it wasn't a complete jinxing of FC Tokyo. But I apologies to all Tokyo fans, and it won't happen again this season.
Yeah, no worries. So I don't think we'll be banging the door down for an ACL spot, so we probably won't have to worry about that again, Sam. But so Cerezo dusted themselves down after that 3-3 draw on Wednesday night, headed down to Tosu, and as you say, fell 2-0 behind very promptly once again, but this time inside the first 10 minutes when Noriyoshi Sakai scored in literally the first minute, converting a pass from Tomoya Koyamatsu, and then in the 8th minute, Koyamatsu turned home after Ayumu Ohata's shot across the box was deflected into his path by a Cerezo defender. Mutsuki Kato, who had scored the first goal for Cerezo on Wednesday night, he got a goal back for Cerezo in the 18th minute with a deflected strike. And then after frankly phenomenal Yuta Higuchi, who we'd bigged up on last week's episode, Sam, who was the driving force behind a Tosu's win against Nagoya, smashed in from 30 yards. Yeah, Tosu and their supporters must have been thinking, this game in the second half could be literally anything, because they were irrepressible at times in the first half, Tosu.
They were fantastic. They've started a lot of games this season in the same manner, just completely all out from the first whistle, just causing problems, pressing high. And I mean, Noriyoshi Sakai has stepped in for Hayashi incredibly. I mean, he's a player completely transformed this season from one that played at Omiya and Niigata and was kind of an okay winger, and he's now scoring goals for fun and really good goals. This was a terrific finish, and yeah, so they kept pressing, and Koyamatsu got in behind. I think Cerezo were a little bit ragged in the way that they conceded that goal, but yeah, generally Tosu were completely in control of this game. They only conceded in that first half due to a poor clearance that was charged down, but otherwise, especially once Higuchi had what a goal that was, and to put them 3-1 up, they only looked like one winner. And I think they probably would have been, but again, Cerezo got bailed out by VAR from going three goals down when Eduardo's strike was ruled out for one of those handballs where it just kind of hits him accidentally. And yeah, they took advantage from then, Cerezo, and didn't look back and had a very, very good second half performance.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, it was really unfortunate for Eduardo, wasn't it? Yeah, 11 minutes into the second half, a terrific goal that would have put Tosu 4-1 ahead, but instead, VAR intervened in Cerezo's favour again. And then, well, what about this passage of play that saw Cerezo cut their deficit to 3-2 in the 68th minute, Sam? An absolute, it's definitely going to end up on the Cerezo end of season DVD, I'm sure. But the Tosu players won't want to relive what happened when first Riki Harakawa's 30-yard free kick came back off the bar. The rebound was turned towards goal. A Tosu defender had to clear off the line. The ball was hacked out of the box. Then Hiroshi Kiyotake crossed into the box from the Cerezo left. The keeper, Park Il-gyu, caught the ball but then dropped it when he had collided into one of his defenders as he was falling to the floor. Tatsuhiro Sakamoto poked the ball to Mutsuki Kato, who lashed home his second of the game. Kato finishing off quite a week. I mean, he's no Barbara Bander, but he certainly had himself quite a week with one goal on Wednesday and then a brace on Saturday for his purple patch to continue. And then Sakamoto himself, Sam, with again a somewhat dubious penalty that I felt was harsh on Tosu. The replays clearly showing he had a handful of Keyasento's shirt as the two were jostled on the edge of the box. Sakamoto ultimately fell to the floor and the referee pointed to the spot. So, Cerezo, they do deserve an awful amount of credit for keeping on going in this game. But, there was an element of fortune about pretty much everything that happened to them in the second half.
Yeah, well, that whole goal that you described was complete madness. You mentioned Barbara Banda. That would have fit completely in that China 4, Zambia 4 game. It was just absolutely madness. And I sort of agree with you on the penalty. Both players had handfuls of each other's shirt. Maybe Sakamoto had just got the wrong side of Sento and got dragged down, but it was one where it could have gone either way and you wouldn't have had too much of a gripe whichever way the referee had decided it. So again, another thing went in Cerezo's favour, but yeah, I guess you earn your own luck, and they'd performed very well up to that point, so maybe deserved to get a 3-3 draw out of the game. But I mean, it wasn't finished quite there. Offaredo off the bench so close in the 97th minute to getting a 4-3 winner for Sagan Tosu. But it was just a fantastic game, and I mean, in any other season, if you'd said Sagan Tosu and Cerezo Osaka would play out a 3-3 barnstormer, you'd have been crazy.
Yeah, most definitely. Obviously, that really stung Tosu, who could have closed to within a point of Kobe, who are third in the table. Tosu stay fourth, though a point ahead of Nagoya with a far better goal difference, while Cerezo, after their 2-3-3 draws in the week, are still 12th in the table on 26 points and well away from any sort of ACL conversation. But you're not really looking over their shoulders at the relegation dogfight either. So it's going to be interesting to see how the second half of the season goes for them. So that's the four games from the last week. Obviously, as we said, with a strong emphasis on the two Osaka teams. And from here until the league resumes on Monday, the 9th of August, it's pretty much Gumba all the way. We've already gone through all of their fixtures. Before we record again, they will play Oita at home on Tuesday and then away at Sapporo on the Friday. So, Johnny Nickel, we might be giving you a bell to chat about your team. So hopefully for you, the results will pick up in the next couple of games. All right, Sam, well, it will be an abridged version of the podcast this week. Obviously still plenty to talk about. All we can do is cross our fingers and hope that both the men and the women for Japan do the job in the Olympics in the next couple of days. And as I said earlier, we've got some quarterfinal action to talk about.
Yeah, their fingers crossed. Hopefully the Japan women can turn up on Tuesday and get a very positive result against Chile and give them something to build on going into a knockout stage, as long as they get through, which I'm pretty confident they will. And then the men just perform as they did for most of that game against Mexico, and they should work their way past a fairly ordinary France team compared to usual France teams. And yeah, hopefully it gets more exciting from then on. Do you know what dates the quarterfinals are?
Yes, the women's is on the 30th, and then the men's are the following day. So, we'll wait and see when they're played, and if we can maybe do a bonus episode for our patrons or something, we'll have to put our heads together and think about that. But let's not count our chickens, and let's just hope they make it through in the first place.
Yeah, sounds good. Whoever we are getting, it's going to be exciting whoever they get, and I'm hopeful that at least the men have shown that they're capable of a medal in this tournament, so hopefully they can push on, and hopefully the women can show what they're made of as well.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, there's no point even trying to speculate who either of the men's and women's could play, because, for example, in the men's, if they make it through, they'll play either who finishes first or second in Group B, and all teams in that group have won one of their two games so far, so that could be literally anybody. And then, obviously, we don't know where Japan are going to finish in their group and if they will finish a second or third, and that will depend on all kinds of things. So I dug it myself into a deep enough hole in part one, so I think we'll leave it there. So that's it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. If you'd like to get involved, please head to patreon.com/JTalkPod. And listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back again soon to talk about, hopefully, some Japan national teams in the Olympic quarterfinals. Speak to you again soon. Bye for now.
the J Talk Podcast. Yosh, 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 yosh.